The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Emily Nagoski is the author of the New York Times bestseller, Come As You Are, a self-help manual lauded by The Guardian for its ability to offer up hard facts on the science of arousal and desire in a friendly and accessible way. With her sister, Amelia Nagoski, she is also the co-author of Burnout, The Secret to Unlocking the Stress Cycle. She earned an MS in counseling and a PhD in health behavior from Indiana University, where she has conducted clinical and research training at the renowned Kinsey Institute. She now teaches sex education and stress education to women across the country. In Come Together, Nagoski employs a scientific rigor, compassion, and humor to create a pragmatic and specific guide for maintaining a fulfilling sex life while in a long-term relationship. Please welcome our guest to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Hi. It is delightful to be here. And yes, Steph has COVID. She is actually the second of my co-presenters to get COVID. Many of you may be familiar with the work of Jacqueline Friedman, who is going to be joining me in Boston. And she also has COVID. Y'all, it's not over. Speaking of which, I know canes cause people to be like, what's wrong? Do not worry, I have excellent medical care. I have long COVID, hence the sitting down. Hence, you know, it sucks, it's real, I hate it. And that is also the why I have to leave and go to bed immediately, because I have to get on a plane tomorrow, and I want to be a person in Atlanta, just like I'm a person right now. So thank you very much for letting me do that. Because Steph could not be with us, I write about her in the book. So before I tell you the origin of the story, the origin story of the book before I start. Here we go. Once upon a time, I wrote this book, Come As You Are. And the process of, I feel like it has like helped a lot of people, but the process of writing that book was so stressful that I lost all interest in actually having any sex with my actual partner for like months at a time, zip, right? And so I finished writing the book and things got a little better, and then I went on book tour and things got a lot worse. I would try to follow my own advice from Come As You Are, responsive desire, right? It's not about, you know, like how hot and horny you are. It's about you show up, you put your body in the bed, you let your skin touch your partner's skin, and your body's supposed to go, oh, right, I really like this. I really like this person. We should definitely do this again. What would happen instead is I would put my body in the bed, I'd let my skin touch my partner's skin, and I would cry and fall asleep. And I thought, I need more advice than I have given in my own book. So I did what any of you would do. I went to Google Scholar, and I looked at the peer-reviewed research on couples who sustain a strong sexual connection over the long term. And what I found there was 100% missing from the mainstream cultural media conversation about how couples sustain a strong sexual connection in the long term. Because the conversation sort of in the public was either the people who were on the side of intimacy is the enemy of the erotic. In order to keep the spark alive, you need emotional distance. With desire, you need a bridge to cross. And on the other side, there are the people who say intimacy is the foundation of the erotic. You keep the spark alive by turning toward each other with kindness and compassion and curiosity. And both of those things are wrong, because when you look at the science, the people who actually sustain strong sexual connections, the people who self-identify as having extraordinary sex, the people who pursue pleasure even though their culture absolutely is not one that gives them permission to experience pleasure, they don't talk about the spark. They don't talk about desire at all. The conversation we are having about whether it's intimacy or closeness to keep the spark alive is entirely beside the point, because the spark is beside the point. It turns out the key, there are three characteristics of couples who sustain a strong sexual connection. None of them are how much people spontaneously, hot and horny, can't wait to put your tongue in your mouth, desire. None of them. It is one, they're really good friends who admire and trust each other. I hope it's not controversial that your sex life is better when you really like the people that you're having sex with. Two, they prioritize sex. They decide that it matters for their relationship, that they stop doing all the other things they could be doing. And y'all, we're busy, right? We might have a job to go to. We might have kids to raise. We might have a degree to earn, have a puppy to house train. We've got other friends we want to spend time with. We've got other family to pay attention to. Sometimes, God forbid, we just want to watch Netflix and then go to sleep. So why would we cordon off space, time, and energy just to do this, let's face it, sort of silly thing we humans do of rolling around with each other and putting each other's feet in our mouths and letting people lick our genitals? Like, why? Why? What does it do? The couples who sustain a strong sexual connection feel that this sexual connection contributes something important to the rest of their relationship, and so they're motivated to prioritize it, to create time, space, and energy for it, which necessitates deprioritizing other things. And that's the hard part. Does this mean that these are couples who sex never falls off their priority list? Absolutely not. There are a lot of life circumstances where just it's not as if when a new little human comes into your life, when you're like, right, when you've got a book deadline, there are a lot of circumstances where it's just like, this is not the time. The couples who sustain a strong sexual connection are not the ones who never lose sight of each other. They're the ones who find their way back. Third characteristic of couples who sustain, okay, I'm a teacher, spaced repetition. What's the first characteristic of couples who sustain a strong sexual connection over the long term? They're friends. They admire and trust each other. Two, they prioritize sex. It matters for them. And so they deprioritize other things in order to create time and space for shared pleasure. Three, and I'm going to admit this is the hard one, they recognize that they have been following somebody else's rules, somebody else's opinion about who they're supposed to be as a sexual person and what their relationship is supposed to be like as a sexual relationship, and they decide they're not going to do that anymore. They're going to make deliberate, intentional choices about which rules they want to follow for themselves based on who they authentically are, who their partner authentically is, instead of all the scripts we've been fed about who our partner is supposed to be, and who we authentically are in a sexual relationship. It is not easy. Both purity culture and the matriarchy have had decades to get into your brain, and it's going to take decades fully to dismantle it in your brain. But you don't have to finish in order to experience the benefits of it. Even when you just do a little bit, you gain access to a kind of pleasure that's not available to you when you're following somebody else's rules, having the kind of sex you're told you're supposed to have. So those are the three characteristics of couples who sustain a strong sexual connection. Notice desire isn't anywhere on there. It's about pleasure. It's about liking the sex enough to want to create time and space to roll around like puppies in a puddle of slickwood. Oh, should I get my reading glasses? I'm an old now. Yeah, I'm gonna get my reading glasses. I should tell a story while I'm doing this. Perimenopause is the thing that is happening that is associated with the change in my vision, and there are no hormonal changes that are particularly associated with change in sexual response, but there are hormonal changes that are associated with changes in the actual genital tissue. If someone in your relationship has ovaries, menopause will happen eventually, whether it happens just because of the passage of time or because of medical intervention, and The change in hormones in particular can cause thinning of the mucosa of the vagina and inner labia, and smoothing of the vaginal rugi. And talk to a gynecologist, because let me tell you, vaginal estradiol. People snapping for estradiol. This is the part that has Steph in it, since she cannot be with us. Many self-help books ask you, from decluttering guides to professional success manuals, ask you to envision your ideal life as a way to establish a goal and a why for the changes you're going to make. I can't do that here, because your image of an ideal sex life has almost certainly been shaped by a bunch of mean-spirited cultural lies. Your ideal may involve having a body or a partner who looks or acts a certain way. It may include some behaviors and not others, without reference to which behaviors bring you pleasure. It may include all kinds of rights and wrongs. How many of those are things that you actively chose rather than something that was handed to you as an ideal? Writer and sex educator Steph O'Terry wrote about her experience of learning about responsive desire and discovering the freedom that comes with knowing and loving what's true in her book, Dirty Word, How a Sex Writer Reclaimed Her Sexuality. She said to her partner, "Just because I don't want to have sex as often as you, it doesn't mean that there's something wrong with me. It's completely normal for me not to be in the mood all the time." That was before the COVID-19 pandemic. When I talked to Steph in 2022, she told me that her revelation stuck with her for a while. She and her partner had both gotten a more concrete sense of what activated each other's accelerators and what hit each other's brakes, and things got better as they collaborated. But then, with the increased stress, exhaustion, and depression of the pandemic, her guilt reemerged. She started putting pressure on herself, even though her husband did not pressure her. That's the thing about the weeds in our psychological garden. They can grow back if you don't keep on pulling them. And sometimes we get so busy with other things, we forget to keep weeding. She finally talked to her husband about it, and it turned out he was genuinely okay with not having sex. The pandemic was affecting him too. And it was such a relief to know that they were both normal, and his loss of interest didn't mean anything except that pandemics can make sex seem less important and less worth having. They go on to fix things later on. So normalize. I remember back at the beginning of the pandemic, there were all these people who were predicting like a pandemic baby boom, and I was like, y'all don't know how sexual response works. Because like 10 to 20% of people find stress increases their sexual interest, but the rest of us, when we're stressed out, we are less like, I need to change glasses again. So I have told you the origin story of the book. Let me conclude that story. You may be wondering, wait, Emily, didn't writing Come Together do the same thing to your sex life? Yes, it did. Totally destroyed my sex life, writing of the book. But, and also perimenopause, and also long COVID. All of these things are things that hit my brakes, things that interfere with my brain's access to pleasure. But I can honestly say that when I got done writing this book, I had this 100,000-word tome of how to repair the connection that had been damaged by the process of writing this book. And things are better with my partner of 13 years than they have literally ever been, including right at the beginning of our relationship. So I feel so like passionate and enthusiastic about this book, because it has all, even if nobody, like I want lots of people to read it and be helped by it, but honestly, if no one else reads it, it has already become a tool that I will be able to use for the rest of my marriage. And that alone has made it worth writing. Can we start with some questions, Robin? The delightful Robin has collected questions for me. Thank you. Engage late in life. It will be second marriages for both of us. We have already noted declining sexual drives. Cisgender heterosexual couple, thank you for specifying. practical advice to set us up for success. I recognize you may cover this in the talk. In fact, this question is, tell me what your book is about. And it's excellent to be asking this question early in a relationship. So in Come As You Are, use this metaphor of the garden, right? On the day you're born, you're given this little plot of rich and fertile soil, and your family of origin and your culture of origin begin to plant seeds, ideas about bodies and sex and safety and love and connection and gender and the erotic. And by the time you get to adulthood, you've got this garden that is your sexuality. Some of us get really lucky, and there's just very beautiful things. All we have to do is cultivate and harvest. Others of us get stuck with some really toxic shit in our gardens, and it's not fair because we didn't choose any of that stuff, but it is a growth opportunity. Because we can go row by row through that garden and make choices about what we want to keep and what we want to throw in the compost heap to rot. So when you get into a long-term relationship, early in any sexual connection, a lot of it you spend visiting each other's gardens, and it's like, let me show you around my place, you show me around your place. Eventually, you begin to cultivate a shared garden. You bring over some of your favorite things from your garden, and they bring over some of their favorite things from their garden, and you really hope they don't strangle each other. When it's still early in a relationship, you're early in the process of making choices. You can be really deliberate in choosing whether or not to bring that boy, somebody somewhere along the way. Before you were old enough or wise enough to say yes or no, somebody planted the message. They didn't ask, like, would it be okay if I planted this idea about the ways that your body is fundamentally flawed and unlovable, and if you don't continue to work on it like a project, then you don't deserve connection or safety or love. Would that be okay with you? No, they just planted it there. So you have this opportunity to choose whether or not you want to import that from your garden into the shared garden that you are building with this person in your life. If you have already accidentally imported that into the shared garden, it's a growth opportunity to cultivate the garden that you together are choosing for yourselves instead of following somebody else's rules about who you're supposed to be. I will say, since the person specifies cisgender heterosexual, the book is as inclusive as I could make it, and thus it is the least dependent on the science of any book I've ever written, because the science has not gotten better in the ways I need it to fast enough. So there's a lot of interviews in this book. But there is one chapter where I assume the reader is cisgender and in a heterosexual type relationship. It's the second to last chapter, because the research is so consistent that couples who are not in that kind of relationship are more satisfied sexually and relationally. They have longer lasting, more orgasmic, more pleasurable sex than people. I'm really worried about the straights. So the straights get their own chapter, and I will point this question asker to that chapter, because it just is the case that the gender roles that we are following give us these very toxic scripts about who we're supposed to be as sexual partners and who our partners are supposed to be as sexual partners to us. And it can get real dark real fast. So learning to dismantle that stuff from your brain helps a lot. The piece of it that's like, what is your book about? I'll see if I can find the part. The thing that we have been doing wrong is that we have the number one reason why people seek sex therapy is for a desire differential. One person wants sex more than the other one. And here's the thing. It's not about desire at all. Desire is not the thing. A lot of books about sex and long-term relationships are about keeping the spark alive. And they are wrong-headed. It's so 20th century with their rigid gender scripts and cringingly oversimplified ideas about sex and evolution. I call this mess of wrongheadedness the desire imperative. The desire imperative says, at the start, it's a bulleted list. At the start of your sexual and or romantic relationship, you should feel a spark, a spontaneous, giddy craving for sexual intimacy with our potential partner that might even feel obsessive. The sparky desire we're supposed to feel at the beginning of a relationship is the correct, best, healthy, normal kind of desire. And if we don't have it, then we don't have anything worth having. 3, if we have to put preparation or planning into our sex lives, we don't want it enough. 4, if our partner doesn't just spontaneously want us out of the blue without effort or preparation on a regular basis, they don't want us enough. The desire imperative puts desire at the center of our definition of sexual well-being. It says there is only one right way to experience desire, and without that, nothing else matters. And so people worry about desire. If desire changes or seems to be missing, people worry there's something very wrong. But here's the irony of the desire imperative. Does all that worry about the spark activate your accelerator? Make it easier to want and like sex? On the contrary, worry mainly hits the brakes and puts sex further out of reach. But there is an alternative. Center pleasure. Desire is not what matters. Not passion, not keeping the spark alive. Pleasure is what matters. Center pleasure, because great sex over the long term is not about how much you want sex. It's about how much you like the sex you're having. Center pleasure is the this is the thing you're going to come back to over and over. You're going to keep worrying about desire. You're going to keep thinking about whether or not people want sex in a relationship the same amount. Some people came here being like, one of us wants sex more than the other, and we're trying to figure out what to do about that. Here's what you do. The first conversation you want to have is, what is it that you want when you want sex? When I started asking this question in workshops, people's like flippant first answer is orgasm. And the thing is, most people, like 95% of people over the age of 30, can have an orgasm on their own. And if you are among the people who don't have orgasms and you would like to have orgasms, there are absolutely books just about that, workshops just about that. Go for it if you're interested. But if you have orgasms on your own, then when you want sex with a partner, it's not orgasm, is it? When people think a little deeper, there are 4 main, I've asked a few thousand people this question at this point. The number one answer is connection. What you want when you want sex is connection with another person. The second thing is shared pleasure. I don't just want to rub my skin against my partner and feel how nice that feels. I want my partner to notice how nice it feels to rub my skin against their body. And I want to notice how nice they feel like it is. That shared pleasure is a specific thing people are looking for when they want sex. Are there any other things we do in our lives where we can feel connected and share pleasure? Yes, lots. So sometimes we can meet some of those needs through something that isn't sex. If a person is in a place where sex is not really available to them, like, you know, when you got a book deadline. The third thing most commonly people report wanting when they think, what do I want when I want sex, is being wanted. Feeling wanted, and like, no wonder how many of us grow up being taught that this is not an actual question. Feel free, don't raise your hands. But we're raised to believe that these parts of ourselves are dirty, dangerous, and disgusting. So to have these parts of ourselves not merely accepted, but longed for, and wanted, and embraced, and licked, of course, that's one of the things we want when we want sex, is for those parts of ourselves to be fully anticipated. And the fourth most common thing people want when they want sex, as far as they tell me, is a thing I call freedom, where people have the ability to set aside all their other worries, their identities and roles and responsibilities and stressors, and close the door on their whole lives and just pay attention in this moment to the pleasurable things that are happening in the here and now. What people want when they want sex is escape from everything else in their life so that they can enjoy this connection and this pleasure in this moment with this person. When I was talking to Ian Kerner last night, he told me that he often has young couples who married for really pragmatic reasons. They were excellent friends. They had shared goals and values. If you're looking for a relationship book, there's one about to come out next week by Sara Nasirzadeh called Love by Design, where she advocates for this sort of practical approach to choosing a partner and constructing a relationship together. And they go to Ian Kerner, a sex therapist, because like the sex isn't really there, and they want to figure out how to like get the sex part in place, because they're like great friends, but the sex? And my advice, he was like, tomorrow I'm going to tell clients, fuck Spark, y'all. Because often these couples will turn to something like polyamory, which like we can talk about polyamory forever. But they turn to that because they do not have sparky desire with their partner, and so they think the solution is to go get sparky desire with someone else, sort of outsourcing spark. But, and like, polyamory can be amazing. Polyamory, I have seen it be profound, life-altering, beautiful, expansive love. And also, I have seen it be a terrible shit show. Because, and mostly it turns out badly when you try polyamory because you're trying to repair a difficulty in your relationship. It's like, I literally know people who had children to like solve problems in their relationship. And like, you may feel really great about this new human in your life, but now you're imposing your shit on this human. So polyamory is not a solution to your relationship difficulties. Instead, the solution is to fuck spark, y'all. What do you enjoy? What kind of sex do you like having together? And those are not necessarily easy questions to ask, especially, so it is a true story that I was in a bar in the UK with a couple of very old friends who now had two small children under five. And they were like, so just hypothetically, like when you talk about these things, how do couples sustain a strong sexual connection over the long term, Emily? And I, like, as you put your body in the bed, as you let your skin touch your partner's skin, and your body wakes up and goes, oh, right, I like this. And one of the partners, I swear, leans back from the table, like, this look of disgust on her face, and I was like, okay, so there's your problem, as they say on Mythbusters. The problem is not that you do not want the sex. The problem is that you do not like the sex that is available to you in this relationship, and that's a whole other conversation. What kind of sex is even worth having? So suppose we have a couple. This is all answering one question. Jeez. I'm going to tell this story, though. Suppose we have a couple where they go to sex therapy. They're fortunate enough to have the delightful Peggy Klein Plotz up in Ottawa as their sex therapist. And partner A says, I am sorry this hurts my partner's feelings, but I'd be happy if we never had sex again. I have enjoyed sex. I have been sexually attracted to you in the past, and I'm done with sex. Peggy being Peggy says, well, tell me about the sex you don't want. And do you suppose the sex they describe is delightful and expansive and ecstatic and joyful and laughing and fun? It is, in her words, often dismal and disappointing. And she will say, well, you know, I rather like sex, but if that's the sex I were having, I wouldn't want it either. One of the ways she puts it so delightfully is, sometimes low desire is evidence of good judgment. The gentler way to put it is that it is not dysfunctional. You are not broken. You do not have a disorder. If you don't want sex, you do not like. Which, when you say it out loud like that, it's like, well, yeah, duh, of course, obviously. And the main reason couples seek sex therapy is desire problems. Most of those couples don't have a desire problem, they have a pleasure problem. They don't like the sex that's available in their relationship. Does that make sense? So the couples who sustain a strong sexual connection over the long term, here's what they do. They collaborate with each other, because they're really good friends, to create a context that makes it easy for their brains to experience pleasure. They collaborate to create a context that makes it easier for their brains to experience pleasure. So what this might look like, this is not me, this is, I'm going to carry the mic around. Because I'm disabled, but I can still tell this story without falling on my ass. Literal story. So, couple sets up a date. Partner A is in the bed waiting for partner B. Partner B comes in, naked, carrying the laundry basket. This is the last load of laundry. And I'm going to put it away. I'm going to hang up all your t-shirts just the way you like it, even though it makes no sense to hang up t-shirts. But that's how you like it. And it is funny. It's funny on purpose. It is playful. And also, partner A is getting their actual needs met in that moment. They have help in doing the stuff that has to get done to maintain a household. Laundry and dishes never end. We all need help with the stuff that never ends. If you share a household with somebody, having that person be helping with that stuff, be like both of you do it and like you notice each other doing it and you're like, those are dishes I didn't have to do. It helps. That's part of how you create a context that makes it easier for your partner's brain to access pleasure. Another part of it is that you do not impose on them culturally constructed aspirational ideals of who they're supposed to be as a sexual person. You don't expect them to have spontaneous desire. You recognize that responsive desire is very normal, and you welcome the fact that it takes about an hour for their brain to transition out of their, like, they get home from work and they're stressed out and they, like, it's date night tonight. And they're like, but they take it seriously. When people say scheduling sex is unromantic or no fun, I get that. And also, there is nothing in my life that happens if it's not on a calendar. And for my partner to feel that sexual connection with me is so important that he's going to cordon off space and time on his calendar just to be naked with me, instead of doing any of the many millions of other things he could be doing, like, that's a partner who wants me enough. It's a different way of thinking about scheduling. It doesn't all have to be scheduled, and scheduling is not for everyone for sure, but scheduling can be for more people than you know, than you expect. Okay. I'm gonna answer a second question. Do you have advice for people newly exploring different kinds of sex? Also, what kind of podcasts do I enjoy listening to, you guys? I am no one's target audience. I mostly listen to decluttering podcasts. Oh, and people all generally ask, the shoes are from Irregular Choice. This design is called Pollen Pals. Botanists will be aware that pollen is basically flower sperm. So advice for exploring different kinds of sex. Read lots of books. If the new kind of sex involves BDSM, there are lots of wonderful books about it. There's actually in the footnotes, there in the end notes, there is a list of books that the BDSM community recommends as like starter guides. Also participate in communities of people if it's a new kind of sex where there's a community around it. Be around other people who have experience and practice. Watch a wide variety of feminist porn if you possibly can. And if you can be here, it's likely you can pay for your porn. Free porn is unlikely to be ethical in terms of like labor and other reasons. So get a lot of media inspiration. Read romance novels for inspiration. If you go to places, I wish y'all had a Ripped Bodice. Ripped Bodice is a brick and mortar romance store that has stores in Brooklyn and in LA. But they curate lists of great romance novels that help you to avoid the not so great stuff that does exist in romance. So read a lot of stuff, both sexually explicit and instructional. Talk to people in the community. Are you a person who is already able to answer the question, Do you like that? That's a real, so here's the thing. I was taught growing up that pleasure is easy and obvious, and that when a partner's, you know, doing a thing, I don't know what this is, but they're doing this, and they say, because they're a good partner, they go, do you like that? And you're like, there's only one right answer, right? Because if you say, no, I don't like that, there's this fear that you're going to hurt your partner's feelings. But also, you kind of don't know if you like it. Like, it's not painful, but even if it is painful, like, maybe it's supposed to be painful. Pain, unwanted pain is the one and only thing. Well, apart from non-kiss. Here's my definition of normal sex. Normal sex is when everyone involved is glad to be there and free to leave with no unwanted consequences. That includes no unwanted emotional consequences. No, oh, but you said you would. No, but if you loved me, you would. No, come on, really? No unwanted consequences and no unwanted pain. Free to be there, glad to be there, free to leave, no unwanted consequences and no unwanted pain. If you're experiencing pain, the most likely reason is lack of arousal and or lubrication. Those are not the same thing. The only advice, like prescriptive advice that I think everyone should follow that I'm willing to give is explore lube. See if you can find something that's a good fit for you and your body and your relationship. Relationships. That's the only advice I give. So when you're exploring new things, are you able to notice what feels good in your body? Because the pleasure, center pleasure, pleasure is the measure of your sexual well-being. It's not how often you do it. It is not how often you do it. It's not what behaviors you engage in. It's not with whom or where or what positions or even how many orgasms you have. It's whether or not you like the sex you are having. So being able to know whether or not you're experiencing pleasure is your guide for trying out new behaviors. Being really curious to try new things is great. And when you're trying new things, your stress level is going to be elevated, which is going to block pleasure signals to your brain. So you have to go really slow when you're trying new things to give your brain time to know whether or not you like it. I have a friend who's like a gourmet chef person, and she says, 3 bites. You need 3 bites to know whether or not you like a new food. The first one is just like your every other food you've ever eaten telling you whether or not this food is that food. It's not. The second bite is to find the ways that it is not that food. And the third bite is to find out what this food actually is. 3 bites. Your brain needs time to adjust to new stimulation and sensations. So when you are trying new things, go really slow. And if these are partnered experiences, explicitly negotiate ahead of time things that are absolutely off the table and things that you're thinking ahead of time like are going to be a maybe, you're interested, and once you get there, you're not sure how you're going to feel. There's a wonderful ace sex educator named Aubrey Lancaster who talks about sex for an ace person who is not disgusted by sex as like going to Disneyland. Like, if your partner loves Disneyland, and you don't, you know what? Sometimes you will go to Disneyland because you love how much your partner loves Disneyland. And you can totally get into it for a little while, and then, like, you need to go back to the hotel and take a nap. And you can't predict ahead of time at what point you're going to need to be like, that's enough Disneyland for me. I'm going to go take a nap. Knowing ahead of time, there's going to be a point when I'm going to call, like, we're done. And, like, nobody's going to be mad. Nobody's going to take it personally. It's just you're trying a new thing. And who knows how it's going to work out. Might turn out to be your favorite thing ever. But the pleasure is the thing that will guide you. And pleasure, in the context of novelty, is not always easy and obvious. I hope that helps. Oh. How do you pick them, huh? How do I have a conversation with my husband about sex if he is uncomfortable talking about sex? Read the heterosexuality chapter. I just made it. Oh my gosh, I made this huge assumption that the person who is married to a husband is a woman, and I shouldn't have done that. So read the chapter before that about the gender mirage, because there's always gender shit underlying people's discomfort in talking about sexuality. There's also other sex imperatives. Read the chapter before that one on the sex imperatives to like explore more deeply where the discomfort is coming from, if that makes sense. So where the discomfort comes from, there's really two things. Like, okay, suppose in your household you want to reduce the amount of red meat that you're consuming because it's expensive, you want to save the world by eating less red meat. So you say to your partner, hey, I'm really interested in maybe only eat red meat like once a week or so. What do you think about that? Should we try that? Right? That's how you have the conversation. That's how you have the conversation about sex also. The reason people don't have just that conversation, hey, you know, I've been thinking, I really enjoy oral sex, and that's something I'd like us to do a little more of. Could that be something we try on our Saturday afternoon date when we have already arranged for the childcare that was such a pain in the ass to get? Let's try oral sex then. The reason people don't have that conversation, there's really two barriers. One, they're really worried about hurting their partner's feelings. Accidentally, because if you want to have this conversation, it's because you want to move closer to the person. It's an invitation. It is warmth. You want the connection. And it is so easy for so many of us, especially if a person has been gender socialized into the "it's a boy" manual of rules and regulations about how do you live in your body. You have been trained that you are infallible and omniscient and a provider and strong. Right? And so for someone to come to you and say, here's something I'm interested in changing, it's so easy for that to feel like a criticism and like a pushing away when it is actually an invitation to come closer. So we're worried about hurting our partner's feelings. And the other thing we're worried about is the judgment. We are worried that if we say a thing we're interested in doing, our partner will respond with shock and horror and never be able to look at us the same way again. So I really recommend, Lori Mintz, the sex therapist, I just heard her recently call it the meta conversation, the conversation about the conversation. I would love to have, because our sexual connection really matters to me, right? We prioritize it. I am really interested in seeing how far we can go, seeing how great our sexual connection can be. And I know that neither of us is like fully confident and comfortable talking about these things. So can we talk about some of the things we're afraid might happen if we do talk about it? And what are some, I was gonna say, what's an environment of holding we can create? And whenever I say that phrase, I like roll my eyes, an environment of holding. But look, when you break your leg, you put a cast on it to create an environment of holding so that the bone can heal cleanly, right? You need an environment of holding around a relationship conversation so that you can allow whatever is broken to heal cleanly. Sometimes that environment of holding means a therapist. It means having a professional there. Oh my God, Nancy Knott is here! Hi, Nancy, sorry. So I began my career as a sex educator in 1995. And the lady who trained me is sitting in that chair over there. I'm so glad you're here. I have no idea what I was talking about. An environment of holding. An environment of holding. As soon as I started having jobs after I left college, I went to the University of Delaware. I was ruined by Nancy Knott Chase, who is such a good boss that I was like, this is going to be great. It took decades before I had a boss as good as she was. I was ruined. It was terrible. It was wonderful and life transforming and is the reason that I am here today. So, the environment of holding. Sometimes it means getting a professional. And again, when I was talking to Ian last night, he made sure to say that it doesn't mean that you're signing up for like years of therapy. It can be a couple or three sessions just to get a little support in learning how to communicate with each other about this topic that you really don't have a lot of practice talking about. You just need like somebody who's better at it than you to help teach you how to do it, who's got a lot of experience to help, like, here's how you do it. That's how you talk about it. Oh my gosh, how is it already? I love my partner, but his touch and kisses only pump my brakes. I've tried coaching, but he's a slow learner. What suggestions do you have? So this is I do not like the sex we are having, and there's so many feelings on both sides of this experience. And if you are with someone whose touch and kisses hit your break, I am so interested in what it is that is creating that dynamic, because it's probably not just your partner. Like, the idea that like there is a certain specific magical way to touch me, and if you just touch me in this way, then like my lights will turn on. No, your brain is a context. Your context is made of two parts. It's got the external circumstances. Your partner is part of that. The relationship itself is part of that. The state of the world is part of that. Your job and kids and life is all part of the external circumstances. And then there's your internal state, which is like your mood, stress, depression, anxiety, loneliness, repressed rage, we've all got it. And I'll point you to chapters 3 and 4, which are about the emotional floor plan. So this was the solution for me. If you are the couple like I just described, where one partner is like, I'd be happy if we never had sex again because we don't like the sex we're having. Peggy says, so what kind of sex is worth wanting? And you explore together how to create a context where you can access pleasure. I think this situation, though it sounds like that, actually calls for the thing that was the answer for me. Like, I knew that like if I could just get there, wherever there was, it would be great. It would be fine. If I wouldn't cry and fall asleep, I would have a lot of fun. But I couldn't get to the place I needed to get to. And so I turned, obviously, to the father of affective neuroscience, Jaak Panksepp, and his 7 primary process emotions. And then I developed a metaphor to help make it accessible and approachable for people actually to use in their everyday lives. So what I recognized was that when the crying and falling asleep, I was in what Jaak Panksepp calls the fear state, which it will not surprise you that rage and fear are 2 of the primary process emotions for all mammalian brains because of the fight or flight response. That's stress. And anyone who's read Burnout knows that connection is one of the really efficient ways to let your body complete the stress cycle so that it can relax and be at ease. So I was putting my body in the bed and touching my partner's skin, and my brain was going, oh, I'm safe now. I can relax, and I'm going to cry to like release all of this fear state that's been in my body. Oh, I was in the fear space. Interesting. And then, where am I going to get out of fear? Well, my body was so exhausted and physically wrecked that I needed sleep, and then generally a bath, and then generally a snack. And then, when I was physically well enough, my brain could go to one of what I call the pleasure favorable spaces. They are play, which turns out to be the most important one for me and for a lot of people. Play is the mammalian motivational system of friendship. Play is any behavior you engage in just for the fun of it, and there's nothing at stake. I wish all the sex in mainstream media were play sex, where nothing is at stake. But the thing is, it's like a TV show, and like things have to be at stake in order for you to keep watching. And sex that advances the plot means sex that like has something at stake. In reality, most of the sex we have, there should be nothing at stake. You got nothing to lose right now. Like, there's no doing it right or wrong. Your partner, in the same way. So you know when you have, is anybody a dog person? You know, the play bow? This is an invitation to play. What it says is, everything that happens after this, I mean no harm. If I do anything a little bit wrong, you let me know and I will back off, because we're here to play. So if my dog, like, he's learning and he nips me a little too hard and I go, ah! He knows, and he backs off, because I have communicated effectively to him that that thing that he's doing during play didn't work for me. That's play. There's nothing at stake. Vacation sex is often happening in the play state, because you can set aside, you're literally in a different geographical place from the rest of your identities and obligations and stressors, and you can just transition into play state. And because we're using a floor plan metaphor, see, the playroom is right next door to the lust room, and it's very easy to transition from play into the lust space. Seeking is another one of the pleasure favorable spaces. It's curiosity, exploration, adventure, and learning. So for me, talking about affective neuroscience is basically a water slide from there into the lust space. But I married a graphic designer who writes a comic strip. He makes jokes. So I would talk about affective neuroscience, not knowing I was basically trying to initiate sex, and he would crack jokes about it, not knowing that he was trying to initiate sex, and I would feel like he's, like, dismissing this thing that I really care about. And so what I worked on with my therapist was realizing that, like, oh, I can go to the play space with him, and not only did it mean that we could be in a place where it was easy for both of us to get into the lust space, it also made me a much nicer person, because I didn't take myself so freaking seriously. It is, to be a sex educator and have these difficulties, like, you just, like, beat the crap out of yourself. This is my cat of nine tails. My father was raised Catholic. This is what I took away from that. Sorry. Learning to take myself, this is the 5-minute warning. How? Okay. So with this, I'm answering this question of, like, these touches don't feel good to me. I am interested in what mental space this person is in when they're being touched by their partner. And what is the history of that space? Because it is not just the external circumstances that are happening. This person, I'm going to recommend sex therapy, individual to start with, to figure out what space you are in when you're receiving that touch, because it is something about not just, like, there is no magic touch a person can do that's gonna feel great if there's a thing in your brain that's preventing that sensation from feeling good. So tickling. Y'all have heard me talk about tickling. It's not everybody's favorite. It's some people's favorite. But if you're already in, like, a really great, like, sexy, turned on, aroused, trusting, playful state of mind, and you're certain special someone tickles you, that can feel great. And if you're in the middle of an argument about money, or, as a friend of mine put it, if you are wrist deep in baby poop and your partner tries to tickle you, that will not feel awesome. Why? It's the same sensation. It's the same person. But your brain interprets it totally differently because the context is different. Your mental state is different. So in this question, what I'm hearing is my brain is not in a state where it can receive pleasure when I'm experiencing these things. So I think it is not just about, like, coaching the partner. It's also about this person getting really deeply connected with their own internal experiences and working, collaborating together to co-create a context that makes pleasure easier to access. Do you think I could, like, possibly? I can't. No, they're all complicated and long answers. So the last thing I will say, this is the first time I've ever missed a book deadline, and it was totally fine that I missed it. 2 weeks before I finished the book, a friend of mine died of cancer. She was about my age. She got married just a couple of months after I did. I got married to my husband. A couple months later, she got married to her wife, and last year, she died. Fuck cancer. And I was right at the end of writing this book about sex and long-term relationships. And this friend of mine, who'd been married a little less long than me, had met her till death do we part. And it changed the book fundamentally, because I realized in this visceral way that, of course, I knew, but, and many people learn this much earlier in life than I do, but we are not guaranteed abundant time with the people that we care about. We are guaranteed change, And truly, it is the way we navigate change together that characterizes the quality of our relationship. So if we can turn toward each other's changes, each other's difficult feelings, each other's needs and wants and fears with kindness and compassion, and if you can possibly manage it, a sense of play, that is the context that will allow you, no matter the structure of your relationship, no matter the genders of the people involved, kindness, compassion, confidence and joy, and if you can possibly get there, a sense of play and adventure. That is how you create a context that allows your brains to experience the kind of pleasure that turns the universe into rainbows, and I think that's worth it. Thank you all again. You left your houses on a February night, and I'm incredibly grateful. And I'm going to answer these in newsletters. You don't have to keep applauding.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.